Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm tired. You know, it's as I get older, even though I love traveling, I don't like traveling for short spurts, you know? I like traveling when I go on vacation, having a week or 2 weeks to settle in someplace, do some exploring. So this last week end was a complete whirlwind of go, 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 network, network, network. Mm. And my extroverted side is a little less so these days. I think I'm more of an introvert and no nature. And so it just like wound me up and like, phew, I'm tired.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not in studio today. Forgive me.
I get
How
it.
How about you?
Oh my God. Well, it's funny. Like, so is it the jet lag? Like, or just why is it longer? Because then you get used to the time change, not time change, but just like you can kind of get in that mindset versus like just going and then coming back. Is that why it's hard for you?
Well, yeah, definitely. It's, you know, it's a time change, but just activity. I mean, I think about travel these days is not about business travel or anything like that. It's more about pleasure and joy and places I want to visit. But this was just this 3-day intensive boot camp and this real estate thing that I'm looking into, and it's just a lot of motivational speaking and do this and a lot of information and everybody, you know, 2 claps for this and 2 claps for that. It's like, okay, yeah. I get it, but how about we just chill, get the information? But I have to tell you, I did not send you a picture of this. There's a couple who brought their baby because they couldn't find a sitter from their hometown. There are people from all over the country. And so they were sitting next to us the first day, and I volunteered to babysit.
I was thinking that. It was perfect.
Oh, my gosh. This 9-month-old little girl, her name is Verity, and I called her Bear Bear.
Uh-huh.
She latched on to me like a nipple.
Oh, my God. Of course they did. You're the baby whisperer.
The cutest thing.
Oh, so sweet.
So I got a serious baby fix for, I don't know, 2 hours one day and like 2 hours the next day.
Fuck it was that. Awesome. Come to my house. I give you a baby fix 24/7. I will do anything.
Oh, you're my so God. Cute.
So funny.
How about you? How are you?
Things are okay. Yeah, so it's been a little bit hectic with my boys, but surviving. And yeah, I'm trying to think like what's I love Halloween, so you know me. Like, I love this time.
I know.
So, yeah.
You're not going to tell us, though. You're not going to tell us what you're going to be.
I'm not telling you, but I will send pictures. And, I'm excited for tomorrow night. And then, this is actually pretty smart. I want to say this on air in case anybody else needs ideas. So, my younger son is super sensitive to sugar. He has it, and then about a half hour later, there's like a complete meltdown. And so, I've been really trying to limit his sugar, and I'm kind of got a little anxious about Halloween because I didn't want him to feel deprived, but I also feel like I don't want to deal with that, you know, mess afterwards. So
right.
I decided that if he trades in his candy, he can get a toy. So that's what we're going to do.
Oh, yeah. I like it. Does he already know that?
Yep. So we discussed it and I said, each candy is worth 5 cents. So like and so of course my older son does the math and like we kind of figure it out. And I mean, we'll see if it holds true, but at least, you know, I don't have to worry about like, you know, he will sneak the candy and then there's going to be a fight about it. At least if it's like, okay, on the night, you know, here's your toy, give me the candy, goodbye. And then I'll, you know, whatever, donate it or wherever. I think you can do a lot with candy these days, but.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Even though, doesn't your school have a
I was thinking that.
A candy drive also?
I think it does, yeah. So that's going right there. Right there.
Oh, that is awesome. Now, well, do you think he'll actually, when the candy is in front of him, to live up to his
I don't
end of the
know.
Bargain?
That's a great question. Well, that's why I bought the toy already, so that it will be in hand. And so it's not like some, you know, random object in space. I'll have it. So then he can kind of trade. And there's no give backs. Once he trades, it's done. We're done here.
Done.
So, yeah.
Done. And he has a birthday coming, too. So he's excited about that.
Yes, he does. He's been talking about it basically for a year now, let's just say. So, yes, he's very excited. So yeah, that's
awesome.
So should we talk about last week?
Yeah.
So
of course, yeah, we had Bill Gladstone, author, literary agent, and I just called him the general do-gooder, right? He was representing the Vibe app, mindfulness, with many teachers and renowned spiritual leaders, and you know, just a cool app that anybody can download. I think it's free for what, 7 days or something, and then it's $2.99 a month or something like that. Yeah, and you get little inspirational quotes and things like that.
I thought it was really, really interesting, like what he does in general. I mean, kind of where he came from, and I don't know, it's just really cool to hear his story and how he wasn't. The main question I asked him was like, were you always into mindfulness? And he's like, no. And so I love hearing people's journey into mindfulness and kind of how they got to where they are. So it's really cool if you missed that show. So
absolutely. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. You do
it. I was just going to say, so this week, I'm super excited because I need all the help I can get. We have Maureen Healy, and she is the author of The Emotionally Healthy Child. And she also wrote Growing Happy Kids, which won Nautilus and Reader's Favorite Book Award in 2014. A popular Psychology Today blogger and sought-after public speaker, Maureen runs a global mentoring program for elementary age children and works with parents and their children in her busy private practice. Her expertise in social and emotional learning has taken her all over the world, including work with Tibetan refugee children at the base of the Himalayas in northern India to classrooms in northern California. So welcome, Maureen.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. We're very excited. So, just right off the bat, what inspired you to write this book, The Emotionally Healthy Child?
It's a good question. Working with kids for almost two decades, it just became clear to me that, you know, I was seeing more and more sort of emotionally reactive children that didn't know how emotions worked and what they could do with them. So as much as it's fun for me to work one-on-one or even in a classroom, you know, I figured the more information I gave the parents and teachers and professionals, the easier it is to get that information out into the broader public to help these kids make better choices. And, you know, I was frankly one of those kids who had lots of emotions and didn't know what to do with them. So it's both professional and personal.
Mm, I love that. That's great.
Wonderful. Yeah. So let's just dive in and tell us, what is an emotionally healthy child?
Well, it's a good question because it's so sophisticated, right? So I guess I'll explain it by saying the beginning point of an emotionally healthy child is when he or she can identify her, let's say her emotions, whether they're anger, sadness, jealousy, even optimism, enthusiasm, excitement, and then can constructively express them. So that's really the starting point. I mean, there's more involved, but that's where the beginning starts. And that's where, you know, working with elementary age children, that's where you really begin with them. And, you know, as you mentioned before, mindfulness is an accelerator of emotional health, but really helping them understand what emotions feel like in the body and what they can do with them.
So, okay, I'm just going to dive right in because I have two emotionally dysregulated children. So I have a ton of questions here.
Right.
So I'm a big believer in obviously talking beforehand and maybe afterward, but I'm noticing the most struggle in the moment. My younger son will just have like a complete fit. He's going to be six in a few days. But just sort of like it's almost like he's possessed, like something kind of takes over him. And I don't know what to do in that exact moment, because before we talk about kind of good choices and how he can calm down, and he rationally completely understands it. But in the moment, it's like there's nothing I can do. And I would love your thoughts.
Well, you're right. There's nothing you can do in the moment. That's why it's kind of like when you're jumping out of an airplane and you're parachuting, you can't do anything until you get to the bottom and start again.
Mm.
So it's similar. I mean, that's why the prep work, that's sort of why, whether it's in a classroom or at home, we work on relaxation techniques, we work on how do we calm, and then you start creating a new pattern. I mean, it's sort of, you know, we all start emotionally reactive, right? So when you're a little baby, and that's normal, when you're hungry, you cry, you know, and then when you become more mature, whether it's 6 years old, 7 years old, I mean, it's really four and up, that kids can really start being more reasonable. But it's never in the moment. In the moment, your right brain is emotionally flooded and you're emotionally hijacked. Mm. So that's why the before and the after is so important. And I think a lot of the before work, like learning how to calm, for example, because no good choices are made when you're not calm, typically, you know, right. It's very rare, but especially for a child. So when they can learn how to sort of become more self-aware and calm, you know, let me give you an example. Say a child just got into the habit of pushing another kid on the playground. Well, you know, having some progress would be when he learned how to take a deep breath, or he learned how to walk away, or he learned how to use his words. You want to sort of interrupt that pattern that's begun.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. I get that.
One of the things that always comes to mind for me with kids is that I think a lot of times parents will have an expectation of their children to be more emotionally developed in terms of their brain capacity than they're really able. And so I have to work with a lot of parents sometimes to not be angry with the child for what they're going through, to just try to understand that, put yourself in their shoes when you are having those moments. And can you speak to that a little bit about what parents can do to stay calm themselves, to not be punitive, and to understand, you know, what's really right in front of them?
Yeah, I mean that's really why I wrote the book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, because, you know, one of the biggest feedback I got was, forget the kids, this is for me, you know? So when we learn how to become more emotionally balanced or stay calm, even though there's some sort of chaos going on in front of us, it's helpful because, you know, it's the magic of mirror neurons. Your children, when they're in the presence of someone who's already learned how to do something, like stay calm, they have an easier time learning how to do that eventually. So, I mean, I think the point is that brain development, you're not fully loaded or online until you're about 26 or mid-20s. So when we have a 5 or 6-year-old who's like losing it, you know, really their intensity of their emotions are so big, they don't honestly know how emotions work, which is one of the chapters I have, and then they don't know that they can handle them. So it's giving them the ideas and the tools that land in a child's mind, which is very different than adult's mind. Adults think, oh, you should be able to pull this together, and you're going to first grade, you got this, and it's just not that way. Children see the world slightly differently. That's why it's helpful to have those ideas and tools that land for children.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
you say that.
And I guess I was just going to say, another thing I would say is, like, emotional health is the skill of balance. So when a child is sort of quote unquote misbehaving, they're just out of balance. So it's all about bringing them back to balance and giving them the tools. So it's how we as adults or parents do it, and also how we help them, to sort of, as a side note, as a sort of another way to look at it.
Yeah. Well, I want to switch.
And you say that wholeness is more important than happiness. Can you say what that is?
Sure. You know, happiness is pretty darn important, so I'm not going to lie, but I would say that, you know, we all want to feel good, because when we feel good, we do our best. But the idea is that you don't want to just put on a happy face if you're having a rotten day. You want to be able to feel all of your emotions. There's no good or there's no bad emotions. You want to feel them all and then learn how to constructively express them. And of course, there are days that just feel like lemons, and that's the deal. But, you know, most kids get into challenges or issues when they want to avoid their emotions, or they want to suppress them, or they don't want to talk about it. You know what I mean? I'm not saying every kid's got to be a talker, but you have to experience your emotions and learn how to let them out constructively versus ignoring them or them coming out sideways by, you know, teasing your sibling. So it's not that these are emotionally unhealthy kids. Those are just not characteristics of the healthiest behavior.
Sure. So I want to switch topics, because I think this is super important given light of what just happened in the Pittsburgh synagogues and just throughout the world, the school shootings. And what advice do you have to parents how to talk to their kids about these events?
Well, it's a really good question, because that's just a difficult one. I mean, I was walking with my friend the other day, and I said, you know, that's why I do the work I do, because if we can help children become emotionally healthy early on, then we can prevent those kind of disasters. But someone who did something like a hate crime or some violent act like a school shooting, obviously this is a mentally unhealthy person. And I mean, the biggest thing children want to know is that they're safe. I participated in a survey. I was one of the people who reviewed the survey for Highlights magazine, and it reported the number one thing children are afraid of in elementary school is a school shooting. So, I mean, helping them feel safe and secure and talking to them. I mean, it depends, right? You want to give age-appropriate information. Obviously, if a child is five, it's much different than they're 18. But you want to help them feel safe and secure. You want to answer their questions if they bring them to you. You want them to know that you're doing everything you can to make sure that they're safe and you're working with their school to feel safe. Because it is school shootings, but it's also just the unknown, the X, the mm-hmm. unknown. That's why mindfulness is important. You can bring them back to the present moment where all is well. Because when we're afraid or scared, it's about something in the past or we're fearing something in the future. So that's why these mindfulness activities, this self-awareness activities, not only help parents and families, but it really helps children because, they can come back to that present moment where all is well, typically.
Okay. Yeah, I love that. I totally agree.
So let's pretend that Kelly is five and I'm seven, and we're both having a complete sibling meltdown. And I've taken something from her. She's smashed a book on my head. I'm now screaming at her. A parent walks in, and we are just a mess. How would you approach that with your mindfulness and all those great tools you're talking about?
I would separate them. I would have created something in my house, like a peace corner or a place where they need to go to cool down, because in the moment, no words exchanged in the heat of the moment is going to be helpful, mm-hmm. but they need to sort of both learn how to calm down, come back to center, and then we can use our words and we can discuss what happened. How can I help you? You guys are your sisters. You love each other. In this moment, you're upset with her, she's upset with you. And I'm sure one of you has a very good cause, and one of you sees it one way, and one of you sees it the other. But in this home, we work things out amicably. This is not, we don't hurt each other. We do our best to make it work. So, I would have them both cool down and then chat about it and see where, five and seven is a really big developmental difference, even though it doesn't sound like it. Mm-hmm. A five-year-old is very different than a seven-year-old. And I would anticipate, not that the seven-year-old's perfect, but they are more the leader. So they need to, I would expect more. So I'd have those sort of separate and then collective conversations.
That makes sense. Wow.
Gotcha.
Obviously, every personality is different, but you want to do your best to honor what they're feeling, not to ignore it. But you want to give them tools to calm down and come back together when they're a little bit cooler. Because usually when we're cooler, we can say, couldn't you have done that differently? And our kids go, we could have probably have done that differently,
Is there a particular breathing style that you teach for different ages of children, or just kind of the classic, take a deep breath in, hold it, exhale, et cetera?
Yeah, in the book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, they have a bunch of different techniques. I think the most important thing, especially with children, and I'm talking about elementary school children, is that it needs to be visual. So for them, it needs to land. So for example, the hot soup breath, which is in my first book, Growing Happy Kids, you can take deeper air through your nose and then out your mouth like you're cooling a hot soup, right? I have other breathing techniques in the book where we talk about, finger counting or making it, having a physical anchor along with a breathing technique is important so that children remember it. And I'm a big fan of proactively doing breathing techniques when things are going well so that they realize, I do feel a little calmer. I do feel more relaxed just before they go to sleep. So that in that moment, you're building a new pathway in their brain that says, if I want to feel calmer, I do with this breathing technique, and it works. You're starting to help them create healthy habits and helping them recognize that they actually have more control of their emotions than they think.
I love that. I'm looking at your book now, and I'd love to maybe read some passages that, if that's okay with you, that I really liked.
Sure.
This was about making smart choices. And so here's a smart choices checklist for home. And you said, this is a sample. Take deep breaths, we just talked about. Write in my journal. Eat an apple. Shoot hoops in the driveway. Listen to music. And here's a sample checklist for school. You can walk away. Talk to my teacher or friends. Write in my notebook. Say a prayer. Do my wheel of feel, which you talk about in your, or hand on heart. And so you have a lot of the kind of the toolbox, I don't know what you want to call it, toolbox techniques, which is great, which is super helpful for all of our kids.
Yeah, and I would say, just to add to that, is that, you know, that's probably a tool that I use with every child I work with, the Smart Choices Checklist, because until the child sort of recognizes that they have choices and they sometimes can make different choices than they've been making, they just, you know, respond on automatic. So it's helping increase their self-awareness and really see the other choices, whether it's home, classroom, friend's house, wherever it may be, that they can think differently if they need to.
So I was wondering if you could give us maybe a couple examples of kids that you have worked with and kind of what they were like before and what strategies worked with them, and kind of, because I think that would be super helpful for parents also.
Sure. You know, every child is different, but, you know, I'm thinking of one child I work with who lives in Australia, and she's about 9 or 10, but she just would get into a funk quite often and got into a sort of a pessimistic pattern of seeing, you know, seeing and expecting things not to work out. Mm-hmm. So with her, I helped her do more of a gratitude list every day. It's that free app called Three Good Things. So I asked her to every day just write down three good things. And that creates a new pathway in the brain for her to begin to look for the good things that are actually happening now, and that life is much better than she thought it was. Mm-hmm. And for her, that was a huge difference. That really helped shift her into a more positive pathway with her emotions. And, you know, that might not work for someone else, but for her, that was the right tool. Mm-hmm. For another child I can think of, you know, she came to me, she threw a chair across the classroom and she was really angry. So she, obviously that wasn't behavior, that wasn't a smart choice. But, you know, it's funny because in her mind that she needed that immediate anger relief, which it provided, but obviously not safe for everyone else. Mm. But when I helped her with the Smart Choices Checklist and doing deep breaths to sort of calm and center herself and talk about what were the things you could do in the classroom, she could go to the bathroom, she could throw water on her face, she could, you know, there was a bunch of things we identified. She realized that, oh, I could do things differently. And then she, no more chairs were flying across the classroom. So I think a lot of it is just helping kids identify, you know, how emotions work and what they can do, that you don't have to just be on automatic. And the reality is we know plenty of adults who are just on automatic. So I think it's just the sooner they learn to my tools and ideas and create some habits, the better they are. And also, you know, what might work in second grade might not work in third, which is why I did create the toolbox with a bunch of different tools, because I feel like, you know, certain kids do find their one tool, whether it's taking deep breaths or jiu-jitsu or whatever that helps them calm and center. But other kids, they sort of try one for a while and then need something else. Mm-hmm. So it's, of course, working with the child you have.
That makes sense. Of course.
Maureen, are you trained in DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, in any way? It sounds like some overlap to that.
Yeah, I am. I am. You know, I got trained when I did my coursework in child clinical psychology, but I've never really practiced that.
Okay. Yeah, because I can see that too. The mindfulness and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, it just sounds like a lot of what I've learned in DBT. I love it. It's so helpful on so many different levels. And I really love your Wheel of Feels. So since we've thrown that out there a couple of times, can you say a little bit more in depth about what that is, actually?
Sure. It's the idea that, you know, you can have a circle, the exercise is like in a circle, and in the middle you put the problem, mm-hmm. and then say you cut up the circle in like a pizza pie, like 8 slices or something. You start helping your child go from the challenge. Say the challenge in the middle was, I'm going to a new school and I'm really nervous, you know? So like the first piece would be like, well, you do have some extracurricular activities I like, or they have soccer. And maybe the next one is like, I could make another good friend there. Like, you start to move them in a direction that's more constructive and positive. It doesn't mean that their nervousness goes away or it's not justified. It just helps them look at the situation from different angles and feel better about it. Which is like, when we're in the moment, especially as a child, they think it's the worst ever. How am I ever going to get through this? This is so intense. And, you know, say they're 7 years old, they only have 7 years of experience. So for them, it is intense. Mm-hmm. So helping them sort of see the positive possibilities that may come out of the situation is a good thing.
And I'm curious, from your opinion, how much of you think, I actually had this conversation with a friend today, how much of a child do you think is just based on temperament versus parenting?
Well, since temperament is somewhat biological, there's sort of an overlap in the question, but I think if you have a good role model, you know, say they're the parents, I think that can be extraordinary for a child. And I think, of course, from my perspective, I always look at a child is perfectly matched to the parent and the parent is perfectly matched to the child, meaning the child has something to teach the parent has something to teach the child. So usually, whether they're both alike or they're very different, there is that opportunity for growth. I think that, you know, the environment such as parenting, I mean, that creates a huge difference. If a parent comes to a child and says, oh, how can we solve this? Or what can we do to fix this problem? That's a lot different than saying, go to your room, you have mm-hmm. to do this. You know, mm-hmm. so the way a parent parents and partners with the child, I think can make a tremendous difference on the child's self-esteem, on their confidence, on their grit, on their ability to kind of be brave and courageous about their emotions. And of course, role modeling is, you know, we sort of, when I work with children, I usually don't quote unquote get it all until I meet the parents. I go, oh, now I get it. I see the picture, because there is that connection.
That makes sense. So we are talking totally. With Maureen Healy. She's the author of The Emotionally Healthy Child. Sorry, go ahead, Deborah.
I was going to say, I love this. So you have a section in your book on insight and cultivating character. And you mentioned gratitude, compassion, generosity, honesty, forgiveness, and love. Can you say a little bit about each of those and also why you chose those particular six?
Sure. All those six contribute to positive emotional health and ultimately being happier. So if you're compassionate, you know, if you not only empathy where you see someone in pain, but you want them to be free of that pain, that's going to help you become happier. If you help your friend, you know, not only see them have crutches, but help them with the book bag on the way into school. So all of those six qualities, if we can develop inside of ourselves and help our children develop, help them naturally move toward not only having a good character, but becoming healthier and happier. I mean, you can't be emotionally healthy if you're dishonest all the time. There's just things that take you out of the game. Mm-hmm. So those things are essential.
Hmm.
Love it. What happens for, let's say, a child when one of the parents, one or both, go through a very difficult crisis in their life? Let's say, you know, the parents both lose their parents simultaneously. There's death in the family. One of them maybe gets depressed or loses a job. How can a parent help to fend off that kind of negative experience within themselves, not be pushed onto the child?
Well, I think it's a great question, because that's life, right? There's always, whether it's a flat tire or someone passes away, there's challenges. That's the planet. So I think we need to be vulnerable and real with our children in age-appropriate ways, but we also need to help them recognize that we're going to get through it together. We're going to learn together. There's always something for us to deepen our experience of, you know, whether it's gratitude or patience or, mm-hmm. you know, just moving through grief. I mean, things don't always have to be easy, but being able to have the courage to face what we feel and to help our children recognize that we're doing the best that we can and that we are imperfect and that we're all learning together, I think, is essential. Because when a child sees an adult go through something challenging and make it through the other side, they're like, oh, I can do that. But if a parent's always shielding their child from challenges, and I'm not saying we talk to them about our mortgage, mm-hmm. but, you know, challenges that they can see, that we can say, yeah, you know, grandpa was sick and, you know, we're doing everything we can to help him feel better. You know, things that they recognize, they realize that, you know, it's in community, it's in connection that we can really be stronger and healthier. And I think it's the child that isolates or doesn't feel connected that has more challenging issues.
I would love to know.
You're speaking about resiliency, basically, which is so valuable. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. So I was just going to say, Maureen, for you personally, who are your kind of inspirations in this field?
And when you say this field, what field do you mean?
Just like the parenting, the kind of parenting experts, that whole realm.
I guess from my perspective, I feel like I'm really working in the wisdom well-being tradition.
Okay.
And I just happen to be working with children and parenting. So from my perspective, like Tal Ben-Shahar, I mean, I do know Michelle Borba. She's excellent at what she does. You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he's amazing at what he does. But I think it's taking the wisdom tradition and not just using it for adults. I think it's using it for children. Mm. So I think that's why I have the chapter on how emotions work, because a lot of those things adults don't know. But if a child can learn how do emotions really work early on, wow, they are so far ahead on the trajectory towards positive well-being that, you know, a lot of other things will fall into place, even when they have a hard day, even, you know. So that's, I find my inspiration from not only, you know, from cross disciplines, but people who are really taking the wisdom of the world and bringing it to the parenting, to the teaching, to the children.
Mm, I love that.
Well, so maybe you could say a few words about teaching our audience, ourselves, and anyone who's listening, how do emotions work? If you could break that down in a simple way.
Yeah, well, there's 7 different points in the book, but I'll give you the first one that you'll see the emotional aha when you hear it. So when I work with kids often, especially ones who, you know, have a pattern of emotional reactivity, whether it's screaming or crying or slamming doors, whatever the pattern has been, you know, I often say in that moment, how did that feel? Was it anger? Was it frustration that jumped into anger? They go, yeah. Did it feel bigger than you? They're like, oh my goodness, it felt so much bigger than me. I said, well, the truth is you're bigger than that emotion. They look at me with a blank face like, are you sure? Are you kidding me? That's just one idea that kids don't realize they're bigger than their emotions. And if you don't know you're bigger than something, you really can't even look to control it. You're sort of on the bumpy seas, feeling like you're being rocked by the ocean, not realizing that you actually have your hands on the steering wheel of your boat. So it's helping them recognize their rightful place in their emotions, and then, you know, how they work, you know, and then what they can do. So there are these little ahas that children can get if you explain them to them in ways that work in their mind that can help them create that self-awareness they need to make those better choices.
Gotcha. Great.
Looking over, I feel like you've covered so many of our questions. Like, we're both like, what else can we ask you? Which is great.
Well, what are some things that we haven't been covering that you'd like to share more about also with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a question that I often get is like, oh my God, I did X, Y, and Z. Is it ever too late? And I would say it's never too late. You know what I mean? If you have a child, whether they're an adolescent or in college or even yourself, and you feel like you've gone off course, these ideas and tools work for children and adults. And often these ideas sound simple, but it's the practice that's harder. We all know that life is kind of messy sometimes. So it's sort of cutting ourselves some slack and doing the best we can and making a practice of coming back to center and calming and sort of a regular practice, not periodic. And I would say that, you know, the mindfulness, or how I explain it to children, is really learning how to pay attention without, you know, a judgment, but learning how to pay attention to yourself. What are your personal triggers? For example, this is sort of a silly one, but like, if I eat bagels every day, I know I'm feeling sad about something. It's just my trigger. It's like my thing. I go, oh, what's going on with me? So we all have these different emotional triggers, and it's really getting intimate with ourselves and helping our children recognize, you know, whether it's a child who creates fists or the face gets hot or, you know, the heart beats faster, helping them begin to learn what are their triggers and that they can do something, I would say, is really important.
And are there, maybe you can talk about like the 3 kind of biggest parenting mistakes, because I think sometimes we don't even realize as parents kind of what we do, maybe setting our kids up for failure. So maybe you can speak to that a little bit.
I would say 2 of them that jump to mind is, you know, children really create their worlds with our words. So just being super careful. And it doesn't mean we have to be perfect, because no one's perfect. But it's like, you know, if we make them boo-boo and, you know, we call you a wimpy kid, and you're like, okay, maybe I could have used a different word. That's not exactly what I meant. So children really just take those words in really deeply. So we don't want to mistakenly give them a word or say something like, oh, you're the smart kid, oh, you're the, you know, we mistakenly do that, and they really take that stuff in. So just doing our best to use our words in ways that help them build self-esteem and confidence. And the other one I would say that we just mistakenly do as adults and parents is sort of not validate or diminish a child's feelings. Like, you know, we may not understand why in that moment that's a big deal to them, but it is in that moment. So how do we help them with that? You know what I mean? So, like, you know, they don't want to wear socks. Like, to us, it's like, just put the socks on, put the sneakers on, we got to go to school. But helping them say, hey, I love you. I recognize there's a problem with the socks. How can we make this happen? We really need to go to, you know what I mean? So there's, you know, usually without the validation of what they're feeling, they can't get to, you can't get to the left brain or the logic or reasonable.
I have a funny story about that. When you talk about the socks with my daughter, who's now almost 26, she's such a doll. I love her so much. Anyway, when she was about 3 or 4, she went through this phase where she had this little red Dalmatian dress, you know, from the 101 Dalmatians. And she loved this dress. So every day, that's what she wanted to wear. And, you know, we'd have these little power struggles. Honey, wear something else. You've got all these other choices. And she says, no, the Dalmatian dress. So, I mean, part of it was just my own insecurity or embarrassment, right? Sending her off to school in the same dress. I had to sneak in washing it every couple of days. But she probably wore that Dalmatian dress for, oh, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks in a row. And I just sort of gave into it and said, if that's what you want to wear, it's what you want to wear.
Yeah.
Parents have a problem with that, screw them. But it's just, like, sometimes I think we get into fighting with our kids about things because of our own arrogance, our own fear of being judged or ridiculed, and it's so important for our children to be able to express those things. So should I have done something different in your mind, or give me some ideas about that?
I think you did the perfect right thing. I mean, I think we always have to make that decision, you know, is this worth an argument? Is this worth it? And in the big scheme of things, a dress that you can sneak in washing, it's going to make her really happy for 2 weeks. You know, I'd rather her feel good about herself and enjoy herself. And, you know, we can teach them the skill of flexibility, which is, you know, but sometimes kids, we kids love what they love, and being able to support them in loving that and putting our own sort of like fear of judgment or being a failure, you know, whatever, when parents say like, she's been wearing the same dress for a week, you know what I mean? Like, you know, just shirking it off and saying, yes, she loves it, and continuing. I think that that's actually a really good thing, because from my perspective, you heard her. She clearly wanted to wear that. That was her desire. And you said, all right.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Totally. And then she had her favorite sweatshirt, which was a little skunk that said the lovable stinker. And she wore that one. She got when she was like 3. She wore it until she was like 8. Till it was like, you know, half her size. It was so cute.
Well, London, my younger son, is like in this bandana phase where he wears this green bandana. So he goes through like these trends. So last year it was like his rain boots that he would only wear. And he wore those for like 6 months. And you can only imagine what his feet smelled like. And then he went through like this watch phase where he wore like 4 on one hand, 4 on the other. And then he's currently in this bandana phase where he wears the same, thank God we have multiple, bandana, green bandana. Like, he's like this little trendsetter. And I think it's so cool. Like, I'm all about it. You know, it's like you wear what you want to wear. And my other son, he won't let me cut his hair. And he said, Mom, is my hair my body? And I said, yeah, you're right. So, you know, whatever you want to do is fine. But yeah, I think it's cool to kind of, I have to pick my battles, let's put it that way. And these are benign compared to other ones.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting because as I hear you guys, sorry to interrupt, I hear their personalities come out so early.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You just see that who they are.
Yes. It's very true.
Yes, of course. So maybe you could speak a little bit about a question that I can imagine some people have. How do you define the difference between for a child to help them grow to be confident without being arrogant?
It's interesting you asked me that question, because my first book, Growing Happy Kids, was all about that, actually. It was about inner confidence.
Oh, well.
It was about the development of outer confidence to inner confidence. And then, like you said, too much confidence is really arrogant. So you want to have a healthy sense of confidence. You know, you just start from the outside, like, oh, I can kick that soccer ball onto the net, I'm awesome, to something deeper, which we all work on, is like, I got this. You know, no matter what happens on the outside, I got this. So it's a lifelong process. But, you know, children, want sometimes to be better than others, which is arrogant. And, you know, I think it is an important lesson for kids to learn that, like, there is no better, that we're all special and none of us are special. So it's the point that we're all equal and that, you know, everyone's doing their best and have different gifts. And maybe your gift is chess and you're better than other kids at chess, but it's not pleasant or it's not an attractive quality to flaunt that in people's faces. But you know, learning how to help them sort of display their confidence in a healthy way is important. And I think that, you know, the same issue can be said for underconfidence. You know, you don't want a child who is lacking confidence. They really do need to develop their self-esteem and their ability to be brave, especially if we tie it to emotions. It takes a lot of courage to handle challenging emotions, you know, whether it's jealousy or feeling left out or depressed. I mean, there's a lot of just raw courage that's needed from a child to handle these challenging emotions. So it is something, I know that confidence is a skill to learn, but you don't want to, like, just give blanket praise. Oh, you're a wonderful child. You're great at everything. Because then they can develop that arrogance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes total sense. I think everything's kind of this delicate balance. You know, one of my favorite books, by the way, is The Blessing of a Skin Knee. And I'm wondering if you've ever read that, by the way. I love that because it kind of, I don't know, it talks about resilience and kind of everything that we touched upon today, too. Very similar kind of mentality.
I haven't read it, but it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of that same mentality. I love that. Yeah, about teaching mm-hmm. our kid resilience mm-hmm. and things like that. So, well, tell us a little bit. So, again, we've been talking with Maureen Healy. She is the author of The Emotionally Healthy Child. Because we only have, like, I don't know, maybe about 5 minutes left or so. Can you tell us anything that you want to make sure to get in before we end? Or maybe, you know, where people can find you in the book and all that good stuff.
Sure. My website is growinghappykids.com, which is the name of my first book. And my second book was about indigo children. And then this book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, is more broad for any adult wanting to not only themselves feel emotionally healthy, but raise our children to be that way. And I would say just that it's a skill to be learned. And I continue to work with parents and children everywhere. So that's a joy for me. And if people had questions, you know, feel free to send them my way because I'm happy to help your listeners.
Fantastic.
Wow, you know, indigo children, we do have a minute. Can you please make a little summary of what an indigo child is? I love that term. Where did it come from? And how does somebody know if they have one?
Yeah, the idea of an indigo child, which is a metaphysical term, has to do, the reason why they called it indigo is a woman by the name of Nancy Tate, who's now passed, but she noticed they had an indigo aura. But anyway, the idea, and the reason I wrote about it is I saw these types of children in my office, and indigo is really that highly sensitive child, but along with emotional sensitivity, they have what I would call a fierceness with them. Mm-hmm. So it's the child that will kiss you on the cheek 1 minute and scream at you the next. And also, you know, that's it's similar to, you know, the book I wrote, The Emotional Sensitive Child, for helping children who are reactive. Oftentimes, these indigo children have such a high sensitivity and a small window of comfort that they are very reactive.
Mm-hmm.
But they have an intensity, and they have high levels of intuition, and they are really wonderful children if you had a parent and teach them. And there's a certain way to do it that works better.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard that my kids are indigo children. Is that the same as crystal children, or is that different?
It's slightly different. Crystal, another metaphysical term, but those would be like uber sensitive children. So those are the kids that aren't only, crystal children don't necessarily have the fierceness that indigos do, let's put it that way. They're very sensitive, oftentimes feelers. Mm. Indigo children are like, I don't like this school, I'm not going to go. I'm going to be in a better school when I grow up, that kind of feeling.
I think I have one of each. Mm-hmm. Lucky me.
Mm-hmm.
I think mine is probably more of an indigo child. She's identified herself as such as well.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like she was so easygoing. Yeah. Wasn't she, though? Like, wasn't she easygoing?
Mm-hmm. Easygoing?
Yeah. Like, she was very sweet mm-hmm. and not competitive, you know?
Oh, well. Mamas always have a different version of the yogurt, don't they?
It's true. It's very true.
Anyway, so what? How great information. We've been speaking with Maureen Healy, the Emotionally Healthy Child author, which is helping children calm, center, and make smarter choices. And you have lots of other great books for our listeners to take a look at as well. And I think you already gave out, did you give out your website?
I think so, growinghappykids.com.
Perfect.
There we go. Okay, yeah. Thank you so much for being a great guest.
Yes, thank you so much. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Ah, thank you.
So next week, we have The Divorced Hacker's Guide to Untying the Knot. Should be very interesting. I love how you put untying the no in our outline.
I just saw that.
It's like a Freudian slip. Yeah, exactly. So you can follow us on Instagram at Two Shrinks and Facebook, The Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show. And our website is docandtherapist.com. And thank you so much for listening.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.